Welcome to Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech radio show and podcast. I'm Brett King.
And I'm Jason Henricks. Every week since 2013, we explore the personalities, startups, innovators, and industry players driving disruption in financial services.
From incumbents to unicorns, and from cutting-edge technology to the people using it to help create a more innovative, inclusive, and healthy financial future. I'm JP Nichols, and this is Breaking Banks.
Fintech has gone from sideshow to the main stage. Digital is no longer the accompaniment, it is the soloist. Today on the show, Peter Ramsey just won the American Idol of Fintech when he documented the user experience opening 12 bank accounts in the UK, a post that went viral and surprised even himself. He shares with us the surprises along the way, as well as his UX pet peeves. In the second half, Patrick Sells was just named Digital Banker of the Year by American Banker. Ironically, 18 months ago, he wasn't a banker at all. How did he drive so much success in such a short time at a community bank? He started with mission and culture. This episode is brought to you by Jack Henry Digital, the pioneer and creator of personal digital banking that helps community financial institutions translate their trust in live, local, personal service meaningfully into digital channels for the first time. Jack Henry Digital helps community financial institutions strategically differentiate their digital offerings from those of megabanks, big techs, and fintechs. Peter Ramsey is a busy guy. He's obsessed with improving user experience and spends countless hours finding ways for companies to convert and acquire new customers. He is the brains behind Built for Mars, where he publishes free case studies about product design and UX. Peter's most recent case study, the UX of banking, has made him go a little bit viral, which is kind of unthinkable if you think about the fact, you know, your 12 minutes of fame are going to come from opening 12 bank accounts. Probably not what you expected. And I'll be honest, Peter, I hate opening a bank account. It's like right after expense reports for me in terms of like level of loathing I have. What made you think opening 12 bank accounts was a good idea?
Yeah. Well, it probably wasn't a great idea, right? For lots of reasons. But I thought it'd be interesting. So, you know, what I do with the Built for Mars stuff is UX analysis, right? Like taking a product and showing people the mistakes that product has made and also what they've done right. And banks, huge companies, and if you think about a bank, you're like, they should be the people that are nailing this every time, right? Like they look after your money, you have your life savings there. So I guess it wasn't that I thought opening banks would be fun, but I thought the result would be super interesting to people.
What was the most interesting part in the process? Not about the result yet, but in the process, were there any surprises for you?
Yeah. So, you know, logistically doing, like opening the bank accounts was hell because you have, if you remember opening one, it's loads of back and forth phone calls. Like, you know, I've distilled kind of the process down into an article, but there was a lot of phone calls there, a lot of ordering card readers, waiting for them to arrive, you know, and I had to log everything, right? So every click, every screen I logged, every time mail came through, I had to take the date down and store that mail somewhere so that I could go back and catalog it. So, you know, Just the process was super difficult and time consuming.
How many hours do you think you spent doing this?
About 3 months so far, but I'm still doing it, right? So it was a lot like front end heavy. So I had to, you know, open the banks. That was really time consuming. I had to come up with the whole story of the publication. I had to do all of that. So it's taken me 3 months to get to here, and I've got 4 chapters left, and that, you know, I'll be working on that for the next 3 weeks. So all in all, 4 months of work probably.
Now, yeah. On Breaking Banks is the name of the podcast.
Please don't tell me it was a waste of time.
No, I don't think it was a waste of time. Let's get into some of what you learned in that when you look at, you know, you broke this into incumbents versus challengers, and you know, is the name of the podcast would likely say which way we think it's going to break. In no surprise, what you showed is the challenger banks, you know, did far better
than the incumbent banks. So let me ask the question that maybe others haven't dug into, because you've become, as I said, internet famous for this. Why do you think the incumbents are just so bad at this?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's a case of that there's legacy debt, right? Like they can't get around that. That, you know, we all know that these banks are inefficient and they cannot change as fast as they probably want to. There's also, you know, a lot of the stuff I do at Built for Mars is try and show people that when you pick up an app and you use it and you just like it, that science, you know, and a lot like software science has gone into making an experience that feels great, right? And and so there's a culture in these tech companies that build that. That's artificially created for you to enjoy. And these challenger banks, you know, all three of the ones I talk about, so Monzo, Revolut, and Starling, they all have like a culture of that, right? To varying degrees, but they all have that culture where they want the experience to be enjoyable. And I think these traditional banks don't have that. And I'm not sure they're aware of how far behind they are because they don't have that.
Yeah.
In a world where people don't go to branch as much as pick up their phone.
Well, you bring up an important point around culturally the difference between, you know, a good experience versus a bad experience is different than it just being a pretty experience, right? It's scientific in what happened, not so much artistic in what took place. I'm curious, how do you distinguish between good UX versus good UI? Like, do you have to have good UI to have good UX? Do you have to have good UX to have good UI?
You don't have to have good UI to have good UX. So I would distinguish the two as, you know, sometimes it's helpful to like look at it with like a bit of an analogy, right? So the UI, if you don't think about building a car, so the UI of a car would be the steering wheel, it would be where the dashboard, how it looks, you know, the materials you've used on the seats and that sort of stuff. The experience would be, when you're driving through a tunnel at night, can you fumble around and find the volume button, right? Can you, in an emergency, can you very quickly find the hazard button? So things that, you know, a designer wouldn't, and so the UI, yeah, that it might actually make things uglier to make things more enjoyable or usable. So the two are sometimes competing. Right, like how an architect wants something to work one way, and then the person who wants the architect to build their house wants it to look another way. They kind of have this like battle between the two. I think UX and UI kind of, you know, two separate forces in that.
Well, you described my marriage perfectly there, where it is form versus function repeatedly, right? Yeah. Maybe a little too much on the utilitarian side, but everything, you know, has its purpose. Of the incumbents, who do you think did it the best from a UX perspective?
Yeah. So of the two chapters that are out now, Barclays do the best, right? So I've tried to steer clear of giving an overall winner. And the reason for that is because, you know, this is just my opinion, right? I'm just a guy who's eaten at a restaurant and I'm given a review. So it's not, what I'm saying is not, you know, this bank is the absolute best, but there's no getting around it when you look at what I've written. Like Barclays come out very well in almost every test. You know, if the experience of Barclays was a challenger bank, I think they would be as good as the challenger banks.
Oh, wow.
Right? Like, I really do think they're that far ahead.
What do you think was defining as you were doing the opening process in terms of what made good UX? Are there any factors that really stood out that you're like, every single time if they're going to bomb, that, you know, they bombed on that? You know, to build on your cooking analogy, it's kind of like, you know, the quick fire challenge that you never should do risotto on Top Chef, right? Like, never. The rule is don't do risotto. You're gonna bomb if you do risotto. Where do you find the winners versus the losers in good UX? What distinguishes them?
So I think there's stuff that they all do better, right? Like the challenger banks, they make things quicker, right? And you can open an account quicker, you can make a payment quicker, you can freeze your card quicker. Like, you know, the fourth one I'm doing is on international payments, right? And that's super interesting because that's something that they don't do very well. or at least most, like Revolut do very well. But, you know, the other two, they kind of don't do that well, right? Freezing cards. I think people will be surprised that actually the challenger banks don't do as well as some of the incumbent banks. And the reason is it's super accessible, right? You can, if you sit on your phone now and you try and freeze a card, you can do it. But the experience of when you actually need to freeze your card, right? So, you know, this is kind of what the third chapter is kind of based around, is like context of freezing a card. When you think about the mindset you'll be in that moment of wanting to freeze a card, you've just lost it. You've just spent, you know, an entire day uprooting your house, trying to find it. You know, you're really annoyed at yourself.
Discovered there was fraud on your account. You just see a whole bunch of charges, right? Different mindset.
Absolutely. So it's like, you know, with the challenger banks, there's a button, you click it, you see a freeze icon, and that's it. That's where it stops. They've made it super accessible, super quick, but they, you know, what they haven't done is taken the time to explain to somebody, you know, what happens next. And I think that's something that these traditional banks, they've, you know, it may take 10 times as long to get there, but when you get there, actually in some of the cases, the experiences are better. So there's not one thing that they all do wrong, but I think there are trends with speed versus, you know, attention gone into something. The challenger banks are certainly rooting for like speed and access.
Oh, interesting. So they've clearly optimized around different things, where the incumbents, I'm going to guess part of it is not just longevity, but compliance departments. They keep shoving more into it, but as a result, the end product is good. It just takes longer, versus the others are optimizing for how quick can I get you into this car? And they get you there quickly, but it might not in the end be where you wanted to be. Is that a good summary?
Yeah. And it's different audiences, right? So when Monzo started out, you know, as Mondo, and they were like more of a travel bank, I think, because, you know, they weren't a bank, but travel card, you know, their audience was not 60-year-olds, right? It was the young demographic of people who traveled. And their culture and their app is still built around that now, right? Like, yeah, anybody can use it, but the app is designed for people who understand technology. Whereas HSBC's, you know, you've just lost your card FAQ page. If you look at it, that they answer some questions like, you know, can I do this on Internet Explorer, right? Or, you know, there's super way more basic questions that
only like, IE7.
Yeah, right. So it's difficult, but. Yeah, I think the speed analogy of like challenger banks rooting for speed is a pretty consistent trend.
Now, were there any unexpected results in this process? You know, things that you just kind of weren't expecting to fall out of it that did in the end?
Well, I thought the challenger banks would do well, right? And I thought, you know, when I started, I was like, I'm not sure where this is going to end up, because there are lots of companies out there that do. They're normally consultants, and they normally do analysis of like the UX or the features of a bank, right? And normally they're incredibly dry to read and not consumer friendly. So I didn't know what the approach was going to be. I was like, I don't know where this is going to end up, but I'll go along with it. But in my head, I thought it's going to be which challenger bank is best. But actually, as I was doing it, I was like, there are lots of areas where the challenger banks are so much further ahead than you realize. But there are some where it's like, when you go behind the hood of some of these challenger banks and try and do certain things, you're like, actually, like they haven't even started, right? There's, you know, the HSBC suite of things they do is considerably larger. You know, you can do a lot more there. So I was surprised that, yeah, I was surprised that Monzo aren't consistently smashing it on everything.
Oh, interesting. That is unexpected to me as well. You kind of think of the speed and agility they're putting against it. The, you know, as they pulled ahead, they'd pull ahead in all the dimensions, not just a few of those dimensions.
Yeah.
So as you started to, you know, release chapter two is out around payments, and you're looking at, you covered notification times, processing errors, and ability to add Apple Pay. within the app is what you optimized around in terms of measure. Are you seeing the same distinction between the challenger banks versus the incumbents? You know, this might be somewhere that the incumbents actually have a little bit of an edge because they've been doing it so long. What have you actually found?
For the making a payment.
Yeah. When you actually get into, you know, that next chapter two of the experience, once you're in the account and you're actually, you know, using it and doing things.
Yeah. You know, I think making a payment is a good example of there is an underlying infrastructural advantage of the challenger banks, right? Like their notifications come consistently quicker. They, you know, some of these other banks, I was sitting there, I made the payment and I'd sit there with the app open, right? Refreshing. And I timed it. And when it got beyond an hour, I would stop timing, right? I would go, it's still not there. And some of these banks, so it happened on First Direct once, you know, and then I made another payment and it came through within, you know, like a minute or something. But the problem is there's like a consistency where it doesn't always work. And sometimes it does take ages. Whereas I had no payment tests with the challenger banks that ever had that. Now, could that be the First Direct putting through a much larger volume? Possibly. But all the payments were made on the same afternoon, you know, randomly, like in order. So it wasn't like First Direct were dealing with it at 5 p.m., you know?
Yeah.
It's super inconsistent, basically.
And that consistency tends to matter, even if it's a little bit longer. You'd rather know, hey, you know, it's going to take a day to process a payment, and I build in a day. Not sometimes it's a day, and sometimes it's an hour. And now I need something in an hour, and it ends up taking a day.
Yeah, yeah, and also, you know, there's a theory behind if something is quick enough to be instant, then it feels instant, right? And even 10% slower than instant is suddenly considerably worse than instant. So I think the example I use in the article was of a light switch, right? So if you walk in a room and you press the light switch and it takes like half a second to turn on, you notice it. You go like, what?
Yeah.
Like there's a split second where you're like, well, what happened there? And you don't go, oh, well, the light switch was 10% slower at coming on. It suddenly moved from the realm of being instant, right? So, you know, action, reaction to being action, pause, reaction.
Well, I actually can quantify that one for you. When I was a venture capitalist and spent a lot of time looking at physical security, it's at 10 milliseconds is when you begin to recognize the breakpoint. So think about when you do the RFID tag, you know, to the door for the unlock, that breaking point, like you said, you know, it's been well characterized in physical security. That's when people are like, ugh, I had to pause versus action reaction.
Oh, so is that there's a, I'm going to write that down. So there's a, like a 10 millisecond is like a security industry standard.
I'm like 90% sure, like pulling out from 20 years ago in the memory bank, but that is about, it was a surprisingly short amount of time. And the behavioral pattern you just described is it almost didn't matter at that point if you were going to be 20 milliseconds or a second. Like the difference between that doesn't matter. It's just a very binary outcome. It was either instant or it was not instant.
Yeah. And so, you know, with the challenger banks, they have, you know, there is something, and I can't, someone picked me up on this on LinkedIn and was giving me grief about how this is wrong. I can't say what it is, right? And I can't say if the incumbent banks have a disadvantage for whatever reason, or the legs, or the new banks have designed something better. But there is an advantage there because they were consistent. And if I made a payment on a challenger bank, I'm so confident that when I open the app, it's there, right? Mm. It's instant. What is in the app reflects what's happened in real life. Whereas with some of these other banks, like I was finding I was making payments and it wouldn't be there, right? So it's exactly like you say, if it's not there, it's not instant. And so, yeah, it moves it into that other kind of, that other realm. And there's something, yeah, there is an advantage there. I just don't know. I can't quantify it.
You know, speaking of, this has become so wildly popular within the banking circles. Who else has given you grief around this, and you know, who's been singing your accolades along the way? You know, what has that response been like?
Yeah. So I tell you, the people giving me grief are, there's not many, there's like three. And one of them in particular follows, because this went nuts on LinkedIn. It had, so just people that sent me screenshots of their posts, there's more than 3 million impressions, right? And I counted like 50,000 likes or something stupid over a bunch of posts. So I've never seen a post do as well on LinkedIn. But there's one guy that was following me around. He worked at a bank. I won't name it because it's not fair on the bank, but he worked at a bank and he was just like basically calling me a liar, saying I made up the stats. Now, what's interesting is I've had a lot of the banks contact me and they've all been super nice, right? Even some of the banks that performed the worst, right? I've had messages from them, like super senior execs who have emailed me and been like, hey, you know, we're really sorry, like we messed up. Like this isn't what it's normally like. And, you know, just wanted to let you know, like the study, think you've been really fair, but you know, we should have done better. And you know, that's exactly how these banks should react. And it shows what kind of, you know, not a single bank has come back and been annoyed or been like, that's not fair or that's not true. The people getting annoyed is almost like people who think the banks are going to get annoyed, right?
Okay.
But yeah.
So of the other UX studies that you've done, have any of them come near to this kind of level of social media fervor?
So this is the first publication, right? So
okay.
I've done case studies, which are like 70 slide analysis. And that you could read one in like 5 minutes. This was my first like long form, I'm going to spend a decent amount of time looking at something. And I thought it would do well, but this is, it's gone, you know, I was lucky. It caught a wind somewhere, right? Yeah. And it went nuts. And I think I did well with the articles, but I didn't do well enough that it should have done as well as it did. It caught something, you know, so do I think I would replicate that with another article? Like probably not, but I would love to do more publications like this, right? I think there are other industries that you could really, you know, you could really show people the difference between. So one I really like is like car UI systems.
Yeah.
Because they're all terrible, right? Like the only exception is Tesla, who I think have an incredible UI, right?
Well, so who has the worst of the car UIs in your experience?
Well, that's why I haven't.
Or a worse feature of it. Like, is there anything like, is the BMW knob?
Have you ever tried to use a touchscreen in a car that's not a Tesla?
Oh yeah. Well, it's
they're laggy. They don't work properly. And then you have the wheel that you have to turn, and sometimes it goes left, sometimes it goes up, you know, but anyway, so I think, but this is the first like long form publication I've done to that extent.
Whether you have done a case study on it or not, what UXs like do you ever look at from a product and just go like, that was beautiful, I'm going to become emotional that, you know, this experience just exceeded expectations?
Yeah. I texted, it's funny because that normally doesn't happen to me because I've, you know, I see so many problems and stuff. I find it difficult to like watch movies or like enjoy tech. But this morning I texted a friend of mine and said, the MailChimp app on iOS is like a masterpiece, right? It genuinely is like the MailChimp, whoever designed the MailChimp app and whatever team was involved in that, like they've made something really special there.
And the mobile app, not the online version of it?
Yeah, the mobile app. The online, it's all, you know, the online one's all right. There's a lot of feature there. And I think a lot of it gets quite complicated, but the mobile app, they've distilled it down to the stuff you need. And they've done some really nice like interactions. So, you know, instead of having, for example, like a, you know, the like, are you sure box, right? It's like you click and it's like, are you sure? They have like hold down and then you see a little loader just to make sure you're not like pressing it by mistake and stuff. And they've really thought about it basically.
That is a beautiful, and this idea of distillation, right, is important. Like far too often, because omnichannel is thrown around too much within financial services, this idea that everything in the mobile app should be everything you can do on the web, and they lose that context piece you were talking about. Kind of like the car navigation system, right? Like there's a reason it says don't use while driving, because your laggy, crappy system with buttons that are too small and that I'm poking at while trying to update the driving directions is means I'm going to hit someone, but it's the system's fault. Not that, you know, had they done a better job of, hey, you're moving, maybe, and I just gave you new directions, maybe it should be just one big button, not... Yeah. You know, a whole bunch of others.
Yeah, context is the biggest problem. So, you know, a kind of banking example that I also quite like is of a cash machine, right? So if you were going to design a cash machine now for, like, you know, 2020, and someone said to you, okay, you've got two users. One is, you know, a 40-year-old lady who's gone shopping and she's got two kids and she wants to get cash out for food or whatever, right? You would design a cash machine that looks probably something somewhat similar to what a cash machine is like today, right? It's quite easy to use, it's whatever. Maybe the screen could be a little bit brighter. But if you were designing a cash machine for inside a nightclub at 3 a.m, right? You would design that entirely differently.
Yes.
You wouldn't have the option to take £500 out, right?
Yeah.
You wouldn't have buttons that you really have to, like, you know, and you're trying to, like, see which one lines up with which thing.
That's one of my pet peeves, right? Is it because I'm tall that I'm like, you know, why isn't it accepting?
Right. So context is just when you take something out of the test bed that you made it and you put it in the real world, stuff happens, right? So someone gets drunk, someone is small or tall, or someone has bad eyesight. And I don't believe anybody would design a cash machine for drunk people that it is like today. So it's like, why don't cash machines have two different UIs, one for at 3 a.m. and one for during the day?
Or just sell one to certain locations, like, hey, right, cash machine for bars, because most bars have one.
Yeah, right? Like, but I've never seen that. And that's because, hey, these guys, they're not listening to context. What they do is we've designed a cash machine. We're going to get 100 people to come into our office and use this cash machine. How did you find it? I found it fine, right? And then they build 1 million of them and they put it out and then that's it. They're done. You know, I've obviously simplified that, but, you know, there are so many different contexts of just a cash machine. I could spend my entire life going around and just building cash machines for different contexts, right? And you would find all these different examples of actually, you know, that did make my experience better. I did do that quicker. I do feel like that was, you know, maybe worth the £1 withdrawal fee it charged me, right?
Yeah, I can see that. Are there other places, so context is a great example, are there other things when you think about financial services where we tend to build for the masses and it is a bit one size fits all, you know, in a bank's approach and it loses that context? Are there other rules of thumb when you think about a UX project that you say, you know, it's about context, it's about, you know, what else is on those list of things to consider?
I mean, you know, in the fintech space, I think, so have you heard of open banking? I don't know.
That little thing called open banking. We talk about it on the show all the time.
I wasn't sure if there was a new term for it because, you know, played and stuff. I don't know what they called it. But so open banking is a good example of, like, right now, open banking is built for people who understand open banking, right?
Yeah.
So the startup that I sold before doing this, that was an open banking startup. It was kind of like a referencing tool to see. It was like pre-mortgage kind of tool, right?
Okay.
But I would test that on my 55-year-old mum, right? And I would go, try this. Let me know how you get on with it. And I never succeeded in doing something that she would, you know, she would always find it was confusing. But in our
so she test, probably was thinking that you were about to move home because this was not going to work out for you.
Right. Right. So, you know, but my point is, like, open banking has a huge way to go before it will be accepted universally, right? It's growing and, you know, I've got a lot of faith in the companies that do it. So, like, Plaid is a good example of a company that I think does really well. And, you know, Plaid have a really good experience, but then they are reliant on the banks also providing, like, an experience. And I, you know, maybe Plaid's a bad example, but in the UK, the actual open banking journey is handled by the banks themselves. So these people will have, like, an experience and then they'll kick you off to Barclays to, like, do your open banking thing. right? And these experiences between all the banks, they're not great. You know, so you have a really nice bit of software, you then get kicked off to your legacy bank, open banking bit of software that's super lame, right? And yeah, super buggy. And you're asking someone to give you your banking details and like banking credentials, and it's like, this just doesn't feel right. You know, so I'd love to see them, you know, I'd love to see that do better, but that's something that certainly needs like context. You know, why are you sharing these details? It's not good enough just to say you're about to give permission to this company to access your bank account, right? Which is what they do. They just show that small little line. It's like, well, hold on, I've got my life savings in that bank account. Like, why do you need to have read-write access? What does read-write access mean?
Yeah. You know? The stakes are high here, right? The context, and I appreciate your simplicity and brevity, but you know, this is some place I would actually like, you know, a full page of text explaining some of this to me.
Yeah, for sure.
So looking forward, when does the next chapter drop? When do you think that's going to come out?
So it's every Thursday.
Okay. So next, well, that will actually be coincident with this show. If people are interested, which I think everyone will, if you're not already getting hit from every channel of people pasting it, you know, it's builtformars.co.uk to read more about Peter Ramsey's journey. And, you know, out of curiosity, in close, how much mail do you think you've generated at this point? Like, is the post going crazy with you at this point? You know, having just opened a new bank account myself in the States, the amount of mail that it seems to have kicked off, I can only imagine what 12 has done.
So it's more than like 150, right? So I've got, this is in the last, like, I don't know, maybe the last like few weeks. So I don't know if you can see, but
yeah.
There must be 60 letters there.
Oh my goodness.
You know, the problem is, so when you open the account, you get, so Nationwide sent me 7 letters to open an account, right? So I got like a welcome pack. I had to sign a terms and conditions and send it back. I then got a, this is a products we do pack. Anyway, I had 7 of them. Then they send you like a, this is your first, like, here's your card. Then you get like a, this is your first statement. Then you get like a, do you want us? Oh no, that was it. Then they send me a letter for my first payment. And it's like, there's obviously like a list of automated letters, right? They send out. And I've just hit them all with all the banks. But I tried, you know, I'd like to go on the record saying I did like tick the box that said don't send me physical letters.
You don't want the global warming crowd coming after you.
I don't need people to print and send me physical letters because I won't read it. So it's like, I ticked the box and said, I don't want to receive it. And they're still sending them. And, you know, I don't know what else I can do, but it's been pretty, pretty crazy.
Peter, that's fantastic. Thank you so much for sharing, and look forward to reading the next installment and hopefully seeing lots more of the user journeys coming from you.
Awesome. Thank you. It was good to cheers for chatting with me.
This episode is brought to you by Jack Henry Digital, the pioneer and creator of personal digital banking that helps community financial institutions translate their trust and live, local, personal service meaningfully into digital channels for the first time. Jack Henry Digital helps community financial institutions strategically differentiate their digital offerings from those megabanks, big techs, and fintechs. So how do they do it? With the Banno Digital Platform, a complete 100% API-enabled open digital banking platform. You get beautiful, lightning-fast, native apps and integrated PFM for your customers and members, and cloud-based, core-connected back-office tools for your employees. And with website marketing and content management capabilities built in, community banks and credit unions can create, launch, and track targeted campaigns quickly from click-through to product acquisition across all digital channels. My favorite part of the platform is Banno Conversations, a first-of-its-kind, fully authenticated, secure chat capability that puts branch staff front and center in real time at the moment of need, extending the relationship-based banking model, and restoring community financial institutions' ability to sell in the context of live digital service. You really have to see this feature to fully understand its potential. Visit Banno.com to schedule a demo today. That's BANNO.com.
The SBA issued final guidance on PPP loan forgiveness, and now there are more questions than answers. Lenders are finding themselves asking questions like, what if the loan forgiveness process is such a pain that borrowers don't complete the forgiveness and the lender gets stuck with a bunch of low interest loans? Or how about when the feds come knocking? How do we make sure we're 100% compliant? AlphaRank helps answer all these questions by automating the entire process. It's like TurboTax for PPP loan forgiveness. There's no integration needed. You just sign your paperwork and start using the tool in less than 48 hours. AlphaRank is also trusted by major financial institutions. Visit alpharank.io/Brett King to learn more. That's alpharank.io/Brett King. Mention you heard this ad on the Brett King Breaking Banks podcast and you'll get a 20% discount.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
And now, here's more Breaking Banks.
Is your razor in quarantine? I can assure you mine is not. I look in horror at some of these Zoom calls and see Grizzly Adam sitting across from me. In fact, I think a few people have been cheating and started growing their facial hair in advance of the stay-at-home orders. So what do? I use Harry's. Why? Because razors are very expensive and cheap ones, well, they hurt. And this is where Harry's comes in. They build some of the best blades in the industry and they've done it by cutting out the middleman, manufacturing their blades in their German blade factory that's been honing precision blades for a century, which means you get an incredibly high quality blade at factory direct prices, just $2 per blade. And the direct is also an important aspect and benefit right now. Those refills can arrive straight at your doorstep on a schedule, with or without a subscription. I love what the company stands for too. Already they were donating 1% of proceeds being put aside for nonprofit organizations devoted to helping provide access to better healthcare for men and veterans. And to help those in need right now, Harry's is donating $1 million worth of shaving supplies to hospitals across the US. Listeners of the Breaking Banks show can redeem their Harry's trial set at harrys.com/fintech. You'll get a weighted ergonomic handle for a firm grip, 5-blade razor with a lubricating strip and trimmer blade, rich lathering shave gel with alloy to keep your skin hydrated, and when we can actually travel again, a blade cover to keep your razor dry and easy to grab on the go. Go to harrys.com/fintech to start shaving better today. Excited to have one of Alloy Labs members here, Patrick Sells, who's the Chief Innovation Officer at Quantic Bank, and excited to have you on because of Alloy Labs, although we might talk about that. You were just named by American Banker as the Digital Banker of the Year. And it's two things to note. As far as I could tell, you are both the youngest Digital Banker of the Year they've ever awarded and also the smallest institution. So hitting, you know, way above your weight class. I got to say, you also are the only picture that I saw of the person named Digital Banker who didn't wear socks. You know, the important note, you know, what sets you apart. So, and maybe actually the most astounding part in that whole story is you're not a traditional banker. I mean, one might say you're not really a banker at all, that as you came into this to be named Digital Banker. You know, can you share a little bit of the journey, Patrick, on how did you end up at Quantic? And then we'll get into, you know, how you found yourself being a banker.
Yeah, great to be on with you, Jason. And it's a great honor today, both for myself and I think the team at Quantic at large, to be recognized as the Digital Banker of the Year from American Banker. And you're right. In many ways, I'm probably not considered a banker. I don't know if 18 months in the industry is even enough to qualify me as a banker, but I got into Quantic. Originally, I was running my marketing company, which was based in Indiana, that I'd started when I was in college, and it's really the only job I'd ever had. And Quantic was a client of mine for about 6 months. before I would make the switch to come over to work at Quantic. And I think a couple of things stood out to me in that, and over the 8 or 9 years of running an agency, I'd worked in almost every single industry but banking. And it wasn't because of a lack of desire on my part. I think I didn't understand how to speak to bankers about what they needed to hear from me as a vendor, because I wasn't inside the world. And so despite having many relationships, was never able to really engage. And then Quantic was the first time. And I think it was because it was really about helping marketing on the mortgage side of the business, not the bank itself. And so Quantic had a need where is needing to replace its balance sheet essentially on the deposit side with core deposits, and to do that digitally as opposed to the wholesale funding sources we had used. And it was kind of a great opportunity for my skill set and background and what Quantic needed. You know, and I think what we've done at Quantic, and one of the things that I realized was the importance of storytelling in particular.
Okay.
I don't think a lot of banks know how to tell a story, right? And I think that both internally and externally, and really trying to do something different culturally. And that's been a big focus, you know, these last 18 months is what is the story that we're trying to tell?
Well, so let's talk about that story. You know, what is the story that Quantic said, you know, it both is saying internally and externally, because it's a pretty powerful one, if not a succinct one as well.
You know, we rolled out a new mission statement that's very provocative and probably unique for banks in that we exist to, you know, we want to break the system for financial empowerment. And I think that kind of tells the story of what we're trying to do. If you look at that in two separate chunks. So at first, you have to break the system. And that's kind of this rebellious, almost think like Apple-esque back in the day when they were taking on, you know, IBM and Microsoft. And that there's a deep belief that banking can be done differently in all facets. And I think from culture, employees, who you attract, who you recruit, I think one of the interesting things I noticed about banking was most banks are stocked with staff that are lifelong bankers.
Yep.
Don't see a lot of cross-pollination. And that was unique to me. And so I think there's a story of what part of what we're trying to do is to be different in every way. But there's a reason for it. It's not just to be different. And that goes to the second half of that statement, which is for financial empowerment. And wanting to think about how do we truly laser in on groups of people and empower them financially. We're not trying to solve it for everyone, but I think there's a really unique and powerful story of saying, look, we want to do things differently for niche audiences that we know we can go in and tangibly help.
So you come in, and the reason I wanted to highlight the age earlier is you come in as a non-banker, right? You're not a lifelong banker. Second, you know, you're probably what, half the age of most of the rest of the executive team, or pretty close, and come in with a bold set of ideas. And banks and, you know, just financial institutions broadly are not known for being accepting of bold new moves. What was the reaction internally at Quantic to this type of change?
Well, first, I think a lot of credit's due to our CEO and owner, Steve Schnall. I mean, he really was the one, I think, who, like myself, actually, he's not from banking. And so, you know, I think it freed him to probably make some decisions around like hiring me and what I would do that probably most CEOs of other banks would never have considered. And so definitely recognize that played a huge piece of it. I think in terms of the staff, you know, when I first began talking about ways to do things, it was almost comical probably to them, because yeah, I would come up with an idea and it wasn't just like there was one problem to solve to make it happen. It wasn't even possible to do, right? And I just had no clue that it wasn't possible. And in some ways, I probably sounded so silly that it didn't frustrate them as much, because they realized they just had to help me understand and educate things, you know, educating how banks work. And I think over those first 6 months, we really began to develop our dance as to how to do things differently. And we were both very open to listening to each other. And I think we were able to pretty radically change the culture.
That's how I felt when I was leading strategic implementation at First Marblehead back in the early 2000s. It kind of felt like the senior folks were patting me on the head going, oh, how cute. The little puppy has some ideas. He has no clue. but you've been able to bring people over to your side. Could you give some examples of maybe some of the people who said that's not possible, who've now turned into, you know, superheroes of innovation internally?
Yeah, one of the first people that, two people coming to mind right away, and that's the person who runs IT for us, right? And oversees vendors and IT and our data, and he just thought I was out of my mind. And the person who oversees bank operations, you know, one of the most regulated by the box areas. And I think now they are two of probably the strongest supporters and champions of what we're doing at Quantic. And I think part of what happened or why we were able to make so much change was we recognized the need to have a common language, right? Here I am, this kid from Indiana talking very differently. And here are these two New York lifelong bankers. And we had to come up with a common language that would work for us and the whole staff so that we could really begin to move forward. And I think those two have really championed that. And it's been a huge reason for the success and progress we've made.
Now, talking about failing and failing fast are really easy words, you know, to kind of bandy about, but really internalizing and, you know, doing those and failing for a purpose. Because I think you've been great about saying all of this has to be done with an end in mind. It isn't just about innovation theater. Do you have any examples of what happened? Like, were there any spectacular failures or small failures? How was that first, you know, kind of actual failure accomplished, and how did people respond?
Yeah, so I think that's probably a great area where you can see what was the response to failure when we started is now very different than it is today. You know, when we first started, if there was any amount of, let's say, fraud that happened, it was code red, shut the system down, right? If we had, even if three, you know, if too many phone calls were coming in and our staff couldn't pick them all up, it was, we got to stop this and shut it down, right? And now I think we look at failures, like we have a pretty large one where we've been trying to launch a new mobile and online banking product for over a year, and we've continued to run into issues with our partner on that. And I think now, you know, the team's much, much more able to recognize, you know, the goal here is progress, not perfection. And it was actually summed up so well. And that's one of our core values and part of that common language I talked about. But the person, that bank ops person I mentioned just a minute ago, she's been the one leading this. And so 14, 15 months into working on this project and devoting so much time and energy and frustration to get to a point where we were able to say it's not working and we were going to make a switch as to what we were going to do, I thought she would be absolutely ticked off, frustrated at me, and frustrated about the situation. And her only comment was, I'm not mad at all. We've learned so much and it's going to help us, you know, with what we do going forward. And I think, you know, she really embodies the idea of progress, not perfection. We can't strive for perfection because we're never going to get it, but we can always be in a state of progress. And that may mean mistakes, but looked at in that way, those aren't mistakes. And I think that was one of the big things I had to normalize at Quantic, was mistakes wouldn't get you fired. Mistakes won't get you punished. If you can actually be great at making mistakes and owning them and talking about them, you will be one of the leaders in the bank, right? And that's a huge part of what we've been working on.
Yeah. One of my angel investments, Blue Leaf, that works in the RIA space, has been rolling out this program around it where they actually have done a really stringent definition of failure. And they talked about what are good failures and what are bad failures, right? Like, poor execution is a bad failure. So let's not throw it into the same camp as, you know, like a failure to plan, right? And having a contingency for, you know, what if this does blow up the call center? You know, what would we do? That's a bad failure. It not working the way we expected, but we learned something, is a good failure. It not working and us not having a plan to capture any learning from it is a bad failure. And I love that they started to split that apart. They almost need two different words for it.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. One of our other core values, there's four of them, is called Know the Goal. And the idea behind that, and I think this is, helps frame up a culture of being able to fail and fail in a good way, is to say, okay, look, we can try anything as long as we upfront know what are the outcomes that we're looking for, right? And if we can measure that, then we're not really failing, because all we were trying to see was, did that activity or that partnership create more or less outcomes than we thought we needed? And if it created less, that's fine. So I always tell the team, you can try anything you want, but you have to first know what the outcomes are, and then we go try anything, right? And there's really no bad failure in that lens for me.
Can you give some examples of how you define the outcome? Because this is in our work with banks, we often find they're operating at the wrong level in terms of how they're measuring what that outcome is.
Yeah, so a couple come to mind. Probably the easiest is in how we thought about the account onboarding process of what we were doing. So, you know, it wasn't we didn't want to just allow for digital account creation. We wanted to see certain things. How much friction was in the customer experience? What percentage of people would get through the application successfully, right? That's an outcome we cared about. What percentage of fraud would we allow or could we live with? We know there will always be fraud, and there you have to find that equilibrium between how much friction you put in the experience. That's going to lower your fraud, but it's also going to increase the number of people who have a bad experience and get through, right? And so we always tried to say, look, let's think through the three or four or five, and there should always be multiple outcomes. And then we can begin to look at, okay, did this technology help? Did that technology help? And where did it move those needles? And along that, just in that journey alone, we've, I think, used five different technology vendors in 14 months. And most banks are, you know, one vendor for 5 years, right?
Oh, at least 5 years.
I think that was an important outcome, is we actually at a high level, there is so, for about every dollar we spend on something new, I'm okay with 20% of it being wasted in a product that we don't want to use anymore, right? So we actually have a budget to say, okay, so what? We spent $20,000. It didn't help us. No one's in trouble. It's a part of the outcomes we expect, actually.
Well, and that's such an important point, because I know many a bank, and you do too, that will debate endlessly, you know, this, should we make this $20,000 investment? You know, another Alloy Lab member, Brian Greenbaum at Reading Cooperative Bank, has told me, he's like, you know, we'll have $20,000 worth of meetings and get no closer to the truth than if we had just actually gone and spent $20,000 and just accepted the fact that, hey, it didn't work. And let's move on.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's not only a tolerance that we're willing to live with, it is an expected outcome that I will hold my team to. Because if we don't have waste and technology expenses on trying new things, then we're not trying enough new things.
Yes. Yeah, you're operating in the safety zone. You know, this was the debate with one of my teenage nieces about the experimental method. She, you know, like lots of us, likes to be right. And so explaining to her, it's not an experiment if you actually know what the outcome is going to be. It's by definition, it's not an experiment. What other cultural elements have you had to bring in to make this transformation successful? And are there any things that didn't work as well as you would have expected?
Yeah, so I think the common language, as I talked about and shared, two of the core values of progress, not perfection, know the goal. The other two are try it on. And that's the idea of, you know, just when you go into a department store, you may grab four shirts and try them all on, to only pick one of them, and that's okay. And when you frame it up that way, I think it eases a lot of anxiety around change. Everyone at some level has anxiety with change, even myself, and I'm an agent of change, right, in many ways. But we oftentimes will lead off by saying, okay, we're going to just try this on. And it kind of frames up the right mindset. And then the last one was say cheese, which is this idea, just like when you're taking a picture, you want to smile, say cheese, and you want someone else to smile. Usually both the photographer and the person being photographed is smiling, right? And so that common language was key. And I think also a cadence for how communication happened. I think one thing that I realized at Quantic, at least, and I think it's probably true of a lot of banks, is they're very siloed, right?
Yep.
And there's goodness in that in many ways, because banks are like really complicated manufacturing processes and everyone just does their one piece of the wheel. But that also is awful for communication, right? And so we've instituted top-down a meeting cadence that goes by day, by week, by month, by quarter for everyone in the organization. And I think that's helped a lot. To your point about some failures on the cultural front that we've had, I think, you know, one that comes to mind is trying, it's still the idea of is delegating but abdicating, right? I think one of the things I wanted to do was empower people to be able to make more decisions on their own.
Yeah.
And I recognize that there's a challenge in that with banking, because what you may do in your area and impacts a regulation or a procedure or a policy somewhere else that maybe you didn't even know about, yeah. right? And so I think too often we would, you know, try to empower someone to act quickly, but too quickly or not in coordination with their team. And that definitely caused some frustration and missteps along the way.
So when you look at the, you know, the bank as a complex organism and the financial system as a whole, you know, coming at it from the outside, the faster moving world of, you know, digital marketing, what for you do you say, you know, this is just so fundamentally broken, you know, we need to go fix that, especially as you think about, you know, this idea of breaking the system as part of your mission, you know, what part isn't needs to just get broken down?
Two things. I think definitely in community banks, so the, you know, banks 10 billion and under for sure, the approach to technology is just very backwards. The technology stack, the access to data, how what banks are willing or not willing to do, and the way all of that is set up is just very backwards. And I think at a more macro level, and this to me is one of the most important things, is I think the way banks recruit and the culture of banks is just bad. It doesn't attract new talent. It doesn't attract diverse talent. And, you know, that's, I look at that as the biggest existential threat to Quantic, community banks, and big banks, is we have to figure out a way to make banking fun, to make banking sexy, to make banking about helping someone. And I think that's a huge miss right now in the industry.
Yeah, I had a conversation like that with the head of innovation for the FCA with their big push around data and analytics. And he said, you know, I'm competing with the Amazons, the Facebooks, the Googles of the world for real talent. So I either need to figure out how do I have someone for a short period of time, which is hard in a regulated business, like you said, where there is something to be said for a... like it takes a long time to learn all of the regulation to really develop that body of knowledge. But on the flip side, you know, I need this new talent. I can't keep recruiting, you know, someone who wakes up and says, ooh, I can't wait to go work in a regulated stodgy industry that doesn't change very much, right? Selection bias there. What other parts of the broader financial system? So said recruiting, are there any technological or infrastructure pieces that just frustrate you?
Yeah, I think, you know, I don't know if this is a direct hit to your question, but I spend a lot of time thinking about why fintechs as an industry exists and why it's as big as it is and why more of that isn't done inside of a bank. You know, I look at so many fintechs that I've gotten to meet and they go raise, they have great ideas, they go raise a bunch of money, and then they end up paying a bunch of money to a bank to be, for the bank to do its piece. And I just can't help but think about the massive waste in that.
Yeah.
As opposed to a bank, you know, operating a tech startup studio almost, if you will, and giving that for free to these fintechs, you know, or to these entrepreneurs. And then if we raise money, use it for the customer, don't use it for the piping. And yeah. I think banks, you know, could really think differently and say, look, instead of trying to partner with fintechs, we are going to build our own fintechs. And that would create this whole new B2B marketplace for banks that doesn't exist. And I think a much more efficient marketplace. And then I think I also feel very frustrated with, you know, I think the OCC and the regulators need to evolve, right, in terms of how they look at things, because banks are always going to be limited by what the regulators put out there, and they play such an important role. So I'm not bashing them at all. I just think there has to be a way to make that song and dance, you know, much, much better. And ultimately, I think it achieves the regulators' goals of wanting to have strong, healthy, safe banks. But banks have to be able to evolve.
Yeah. So speaking of evolution, what is next on your mission within Quantic? What are you focused on either technologically, product, culturally? What can we expect to see that's new and exciting?
So two things that are really top of mind. One, on the cultural front, we're really wanting to build out what is the Quantic experience as an employee. And so we've taken like a Monopoly board game and we're redoing that with Quantic experiences. What are the books we want you to read? What are the professional learning experiences? What are the team building exercises? So we can really show over like a 2-year time period, what is that journey supposed to look like for you? And I think tied to that, giving people very concrete paths as to how they can grow their careers at a bank, as opposed to I'm on the ACH team and I'll always be on the ACH team, right? Yeah. We think about that differently. And then most of the work we've done these last 18 months was about trying to fix our infrastructure to launch very innovative checking account products. And we're in the final stages of having that done. And so I'm really excited to start to bring some of our innovative deposit products to life, because I think that frankly is where probably the biggest innovation, you know, has happened for us, is in creating those.
Fantastic. So as a parting shot, give us a few of the books that are on the reading list that you think anyone who wants to be an innovator, either on the fintech side or as a banker, what should people be reading?
The most powerful book to me in business I've ever read is called The E-Myth by Michael Gerber. It just framed up for me so well what everyone's role is in an organization, and especially as an entrepreneur or wanting to be an innovator, and understanding the critical tasks you must do and you can't delegate to someone else. And then I would point out The Advantage by Patrick Lencioni. I think what he talks about how to be a healthy company is very innovative and different, and you can take those ideas and apply them as they are, but also draw analogies to many other aspects of business and banking to find, you know, your innovation.
Fantastic. Well, both wonderful books and something everybody should be reading. Maybe we'll have to start a Breaking Banks book club to go with this. So thanks for joining us, and congratulations, Patrick. Congratulations to Quantic. I love seeing great success stories of, you know, banks that can go do new and powerful things, and excited that you guys aren't done yet.
Yeah, thanks, Jason. It's great to be on the show.
That's it for this week. If you like the show, make sure to give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform, or share it with a friend, or share it on social media.
You can listen to all of our more than 300 episodes, plus all of the other shows from Provoke.fm Media, and learn more about being a guest, a partner, or a sponsor, all at Provoke.fm.
We'll see you again next week with more Breaking Banks.